Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of the Newism podcast, where we talk to social innovators and disruptors to discover how they would shape a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Our guest this week is Professor Pamela Gillies, the Principal and Vice-Chancellor of Glasgow Caledonian University. The university's motto is For the Common Good, and it constantly demonstrates its commitment to the common good through initiatives both at home and abroad and in its curriculum. Pamela is very much a driving force behind that commitment.
I'm here talking with Pamela Gillies, who's the principal of Glasgow Caledonian University. Fantastic to be with you again. As you know, we're in this project where we're creating this new ism, and the discussion is about blank bits of paper in the world. What does a new economic system look like? Obviously, a key part of that is about education. And we've been talked before about the role of education in its wider sense, but perhaps before we get on to that, maybe just talk about Glasgow Caledonian University, where we're sitting right now. What makes it different from other universities? What are the values that this university has that marks it out as special?
And I do think it's a very special place, Mel. I think what makes it special is that it's genuinely committed to being a university for the common good. And that hasn't happened overnight. It's taken some years for us to put all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. But it comes from many of my staff and myself being influenced by educators like Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator. I first came across the pedagogy of the oppressed in 1974 when I was engaged in my Masters of Education at Aberdeen University. I thought, my goodness, we've got coming out of South America this amazing educator who says that everyone can actually change their world. Everyone has the ability to engage in a dialogic conversation with others that will help them understand their world and their role in making it a better place. I thought, this is fantastic. This is why I want to go into education. You know, I want to learn how to be a good citizen. I want to learn about the values of responsibility that will help me be a good citizen. But I also want to be creative about the world. And I want to learn about how I can change the world in the future and not just simply recreate the systems of the past. So, you know, understanding about Paulo Freire drove the kind of educational programmes I was interested in the 70s, the life skills development programmes of Hobson and Scally. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, really. And when I came to this university as its vice-chancellor with its motto of For the Common Weal, I thought, how fantastic to come to a university where, you know, values of confidence and creativity and integrity and responsibility were absolutely built into its DNA. You know, it's a huge desire to promote human rights and generate really great citizens. And that was tremendously exciting for me. One thing the university didn't have at that time, because it's fairly young, it's one of the modern universities, it didn't have a solid research base. And it wasn't extremely international. It didn't have very much of an outward gaze. But it was a great teaching institution. And what we've all managed to do together, staff and students, is to really genuinely understand, what does it take to be a university for the common good? Well, you've got to have a common good curriculum, something that really, you know, does embed these values. It's got to be a curriculum that encourages its students to reach out into the world, to volunteer, to gain learning through experience, whether that's in the workplace or whether that's on the Pella Pepper train of hope, taking law and health and medicine across South Africa. Whether it's even just much more parochially within their own families, helping to care for others. That experience is tremendously important. And embedding those activities within their undergraduate curriculum so they can win common good awards, they can win awards that help them to realise their dreams in making the world a better place. They can be part of our Ashoka network, where every single student is applauded and celebrated as a change maker, ensuring they have the confidence through their educational process to be a change maker. At the same time, they need to develop the, as well as the social skills for change, they need to develop an understanding of the scientific and technological environment in which they work and live. So bringing that undergraduate curriculum together has been tremendously important to us. It's about widening access as well, making sure that curriculum is accessible to those who come from the most difficult backgrounds, the poorest of backgrounds. As I said from Freire, everybody has a contribution to make. So reaching out in a way that ensures young people in Glasgow from nursery, primary and secondary schools all come into this university. They use our great facilities. You know, this university doesn't have closed doors. It's not an ivory tower. And our students are part of peer mentoring programmes with all of these young people. This is because we see education as a system. And it is an important part of this story. And that educational offer at undergraduate level is mirrored by master's degrees in fair finance and fair fashion. We have a passion for social justice here, which is part of the Commonweal tradition. And all of that is underpinned by a research strategy which is governed by the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations. So we are driven by that framework to reduce poverty, to promote climate justice. Everything that you understand in the United Nations framework, that gives us a real goal to aim for. It's important for universities to be creative, to adopt ideas and to try them out and to ask great questions. And the Sustainable Development Goals framework gives us the right kind of questions to ask. So it's not disciplinary focused. It's about solving global challenges or social challenges, but with a real outcome and impact at its heart. And then you have to demonstrate to your students that they are part of a bigger world outside their own learning experience or even their own experiential experience in learning in their communities or at home, by showing how as a whole community we can harness all of our intellectual, social, emotional and economic capital that resides in universities to engage in some really big initiatives together as a big team. For example, we brought the Grameen Bank to Scotland.
I was going to ask about that.
We'll come back to that.
No, but please talk about it now because I think it's a fantastic example, really.
Well, at the time, our Chancellor, who's now our Emeritus Chancellor, because he wants a lifelong partnership with the university, Professor Mohamed Yunus, when he came to our university as Chancellor, he said to me, Pamela, I believe that we should exchange gifts, which I loved, you know. I've done a wee bit social anthropology, so I loved this idea. Mm-hmm. We should share gifts. He said, so you will gift to me the creation of a nursing college that's run as a social business. And I thought, oh my goodness, Mel, how on earth am I going to do that? You know how hard it is to finance education?
This is in Bangladesh.
This is in Bangladesh, in Dhaka. Yeah. But then, you know, with our team here, we managed to do that and fulfill it. And
which is fantastic, by the way.
And it's still running, six years on.
And so lots of nurses being trained in Bangladesh.
Absolutely.
And otherwise have been
to British standards. Yeah. And they're all getting employment and they're becoming nurse trainers themselves.
Excellent. But and it's sustainable.
Sustainable model.
Good.
That's why you need the sustainable development models. And in return, I'd taken Yunus to some of the poorest parts of this city. I said, look, we've got some of the worst inequalities here in Europe. Mm. We're a wealthy country. This is an outrage. And he said, it sure is. I said, I would love to be able to work with others to bring the Grameen Bank to Scotland. And he said, okay. So, and as you know, we've disbursed our first £1 million now of microloans, mainly to women. And we have women coming onto the board of the Grameen Scotland Foundation. So it's a practical example to our students who work as interns in the Grameen in the UK. Practical example of how, a big institution, which is seen as by some of them a bit old-fashioned, it's university, but how we're flexible, how we're looking forward to tomorrow. We're not rooted in today and the past. We really want to change things. We're absolutely committed. They have a real role to play in that. We also believe that the knowledge that we hold dear in our disciplines, which is very useful, everything from, psychology to engineering, to nursing. All of that disciplinary knowledge is terribly important. But to solve our great challenges, we have to work in an interdisciplinary way. We all talk about it in universities. It's very hard to do it.
You must be one of the few that's doing it in the world, I guess.
There are others. Yeah. We're not the only ones, I promise. There are others.
But some I notice, have these kind of grand values or value statements, but aren't necessarily walking the walk. What you're saying is you're actually walking the walk. You're doing...
You've got to do it. You've got to show your young people that, you know, you're willing to take a few risks. Certainly co-creating a new degree with a big business in South Africa, Transnet Freight Rail, in partnership with Johannesburg University. You could argue that was a big risk. It was a new way of thinking about how you create a curriculum. And getting local experts working within the big railway company to help you actually develop the content that was going to be relevant to their needs. That was so important because what that did was allow us to begin 6 years ago the process of upskilling their employees, most of whom live in the townships under corrugated iron.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, most of their employees, 25,000 in Africa. They left school with nothing. Not even a certificate, because education just wasn't possible, too expensive, or they couldn't access it. But through our programme, we've now put through hundreds of Transnet Freight Rail employees through this programme that Transnet pay for.
Right, and then they get certificated at the end of it.
Certificates, diplomas, we now have them completing degrees, they're going on to masters, and they're becoming the new managers in Transnet Freight Rail. So Transnet Freight Rail doesn't have to employ the French and the Dutch and the Brits and the Americans to manage their big business in Africa. Local Africans are, for the first time. And as a result, the workforce is happier, the productivity's gone up. You know, absenteeism's gone down. These employees can now provide education for their families because they're in higher paid jobs. And it's a sustainable capacity enhancement that the company's paid for, businesses paid for, because they see the benefits.
And so it's a kind of win-win situation that's been created. So one of the challenges, I think, when you're talking about the way the world is structured at the moment, and particularly in this area where people are trying to do social enterprise and social entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. and so on, part of the challenge is they're all in their silos.
Yeah.
What you're actually describing here, in both these examples with Grameen, you've come together, you're in the education silo, if you like, Grameen's in the microfinance silo. Absolutely. You've actually connected together and created something else new, both in Bangladesh in terms of the nursing, and in Glasgow in terms of Grameen, a microbank, a Grameen bank here. The other one you're describing in Southern Africa is actually with a business and getting a business out of its silo into education.
That's right.
Do you think we are part of the challenge at the moment that we're all faced, we're all in our boxes, and getting out of these boxes to work together for something else is a big challenge? Is that one of the big barriers we've got going forward, do you think?
I think that is a big barrier. That plus, we're not very skilled at collaborating or cooperating, are we? It's a question back.
I think that's part of the problem, that we're not. So, you know, I often talk about, you know, you have people who are doing fair trade, for example, and some people are quite critical of its actual impact, but my view is, well, at least they're trying to do something, and there's a concept behind it, and you can buy into that concept. But they then don't collaborate with the microfinance people, you know, whereas you think there's actually a potential to join these concepts together.
Yeah.
And are they then, you mentioned fair fashion. You were doing.
Yep.
Is that connected in with universities? So I think that there still is, in my view, a big challenge for us going forward, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it's about learning from one another. So the examples that you give are perfect in terms of how you can overcome these, to be quite honest. And always, I think, probably, if I'm answering your question, you're always looking for win-win. So as Eunice said, so he's getting something, you're getting something, so Bangladesh win, Scotland win. That's the way you create partnerships and come out.
Absolutely. Work together, and it might not always have a perfect solution at the end of it, but working together creates the glue, the bond, that will allow you to take future risks. So it's very, very important to cross these boundaries. And you could argue that our education system doesn't actually support people's critical problem-solving skills or analytical skills or even their collaborative skills, because the world seems to really have gone in a direction that is moving away from collaboration and cooperation.
It seems so, doesn't it?
It's
becoming very individualistic.
Yes.
That we're individuals and we have, you know, we're analysed to the nth degree, and it's about us individual rather than looking at the positive aspects of our collaboration.
And it's why, coming back to education and the economy, recently a small group of us met in Davos, not the big meeting, not the big expensive meeting, a wee side meeting in
a
hotel.
I've been at some of those.
Have you been? They're really interesting.
No, they're really interesting. Yeah, yeah.
And this group was talking about the Masters in Business Administration curriculum in business schools. And was there any way in which we could influence that curriculum to make sure the Sustainable Development Goals were deeply embedded in it, so that the business leaders of the future understand the need for sustainable development and creating sustainable business models? And I would say of the United Nations prime signatories, there are now 700. Most of us would sign up to do that, and we're all trying to change our curricula here to ensure our future leaders are getting different perspectives on how to be successful in business, you know? Yeah. And so that it's a core part of what they do, not a bit of social enterprise or microfinance on the side.
Yeah, so that's absolutely critical. So how did the meeting go? I mean, did you have positive outcomes from that? Did it influence the main agenda, or was it just a kind of interesting discussion which you can have in Davos?
I think at the moment it's an interesting discussion and there's lots of commitment. I've yet to see many practical examples of where the curriculum has actually been changed. But if the 700 UN prime signatories, that's Principles for Responsible Management Education at Business Schools, if they all changed their curriculum, it would still mean that only 15% of the world's business schools were operating to facilitate an understanding of what a sustainable business model might look like. So we have a heck of a long way to go, but at least the conversation is engaged with. But I'm awful impatient.
Well,
I like people to be active and to do things, try them out.
That's why I was sitting talking to you, because it's a question of how do we create this change? I mean, if we're basically saying that this current economy doesn't work, so what's the new one look like? And then therefore, what's the role of education in terms of values? Because to build an economic system, okay, first of all, you need some values.
Absolutely.
So, and we're global. We can't get away from the fact these days we're global. Mm. So the economic systems that were invented were way in the past when we weren't so global as we are now.
Yeah.
So how do we get some values into education system globally that we believe in that can affect the basis of a new economy, do you think?
I think we're moving in that direction by changing our curricula. We've got the Curriculum for Excellence in Scotland. There's much more problem solving. I know there's been a lot of criticism about it. You know, it's not instrumental enough. It's not promoting literacy and numeracy in the way people want to see it promoted. But we know it's a powerful learning tool to work with your peers, to critically appraise a real problem. Mm-hmm. So our young people today, they understand the Sustainable Development Goals. If we deeply embed those goals for improving society within our curriculum, I think we have a ready-made tool, if you like, an architecture within which some of this important values development and problem-solving at the youngest age can take place. I don't mean this just to reside in universities. I think it's much more important for us to engage in the nursery, primary and secondary school curriculum. And that includes understanding human rights or the rights that humans have.
Yeah, very interesting. So we almost are teaching kids the Declaration of Human Rights from aged five, if you like.
But maybe we'd get David Walliams to write the book. Wouldn't that be marvellous?
Yes, it would be.
You know, it's got to be accessible. But youngsters have to be able to talk about it as well.
But your notion then about the Sustainable Development Goals and things like the Declaration of Human Rights being fundamental then.
Yeah.
These become fundamental issues. So issues around the environment, issues
Absolutely.
Around et cetera, tackling poverty, Absolutely. Become part of, ingrained in, what we're taught, what we learn, become part of our DNA, and that's how you change the world. So basically, education is at the core of the change. Is that where you're...
I think it's absolutely transformative, and I think it's our responsibility to make sure that those changes can happen now. I'm very fortunate to be the leader of a university which is jam-packed with staff and students who hold these values dear and who want to experiment.
That's fantastic, and it must be great working here, great atmosphere in terms of that positivity in terms of moving forward. Is that what you find?
It is. It's very, very rewarding. I don't want to retire. Mind you, they don't want me to retire yet.
I hate the word retirement, by the way.
Exactly. But you get up in the morning and there's always challenges. You know, there are always funding challenges. Yeah. I think that's why in Africa, where we're working to help promote the African Leadership University and College, we're looking at affordable higher education in difficult places around the world. You know, we need to look at how we fund higher education. It's true in America, where it's becoming almost unaffordable, where the burden of debt is on the shoulders of young people. That's quickly becoming true in the United Kingdom as well, especially in England. So we know we need to move towards new kinds of funding models.
Yeah, new funding models are absolutely critical. But if what we're saying is education is so key from a very, very early age, surely it's incumbent on us all to work out a system whereby that's allowed to happen so that everybody can flourish to and fulfil their potential.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree.
Reading even recently just in Holland, I think it was, that they teach children happiness at their primary school. That's one of their core things. And a new league table, given everyone's just league tables these days that have come out, have put Holland at the top in terms of behaviour of kids, their actual attainment, lack of bullying, etc. in the school environment, which a lot of the Dutch educators are saying is down to the fact that they have this as part of the curriculum at primary school age. In Russia, I understand that in primary school they teach the children psychology as part of one of the key things, because they say, well, why not? It's about learning about human beings, is it not? Isn't that what we should be teaching one another? So all of these things I think are fascinating and potentially should be part of a new way of looking at education.
They should. And you know, we should actually engage in an initiative to demonstrate in a systems-wide way how, if you actually, you know, tackle the systems problems, you can create new forms of curricula, new ways of learning that can take advantage of our technological developments.
Mm-hmm. So those systems problems being what and how do we tackle
them? Do you remember Ken Robinson's marvellous TED Talk in 2013?
Tell me about it.
He talked about schools just being sausage factories.
Right.
You know, that still in 2013, we're all just sitting in a way in serried ranks. Maybe it's looking at a computer screen now. But we're just churning out young
sausages.
People who are not reflective, who are not critical thinkers, who are not creative, not problem solvers, because the curriculum doesn't give them the space in which to engage appropriately. And it doesn't value experiential learning in the way that the Finnish curriculum does. And I think the Dutch one does too.
Mm-hmm.
Learning outside if you're volunteering to get the shopping for an old person up a tower block, you know, some of our students do.
Yeah.
But I think it's also the peer-to-peer learning we found in this university has been critical for the younger children's development and for our older students here to understand some of the challenges of poverty in Glasgow. And seeing the 15,000 young people who've come into our university since 2008 as part of our aspiration programme, the Caledonian Club, seeing how their teachers now view them. We know that young people's learning is limited by the teachers' expectations as much as by their own confidence and abilities. To see the teachers' expectations rise because of the excitement the young people have in coming here to learn and then going back once they've played with the, you know, the serious gaming simulation, you know, going back and explaining to their teacher, oh, we built the bridge today with, you know, in engineering. Nothing should be off limits. And so our universities, as you know, I firmly believe should open their doors to all.
Yeah, I know.
Because we're a great learning resource. But it means thinking differently about the flow from nursery, you know, to primary, to secondary, to higher. And where does work come in? Are graduate apprenticeships a good thing? Yeah, of course they are. But maybe we could rethink the whole relationship within the system and within the system of work in the way that we did with Transnet Freight Rail in South Africa.
Yeah, so work, the whole issue about work needs to be challenged as well,
yeah.
basically. So it's about education, yeah. sure, but how we work, because that can be described as another sausage factory, if you like. You simply go from university or your school into wherever, yeah. and you maintain your sausage factory attitude.
But if the workplace is engaged in thinking about new ways of learning and improving the productivity or the kinds of drugs they produce or social service they produce, if that workplace is constantly reinventing itself with these new young people who come in from school who are very, very sharp, and they're not packed full of reams of knowledge because they can get that on their phone in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence can, you know, work out the algorithms in 3 seconds,
yeah.
you know.
So why should we bother?
We don't need to.
Because somebody else can.
Somebody else can do it. But we have a bit of the creative brain that can't be mimicked by a machine yet. And we have these amazing ideas that come forth through just a conversation with another human being.
Yeah. So part of the kind of key in this is around community, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, a lot of people, researchers now will talk about isolation.
Yeah.
So we become isolated. So actually materially, in large parts of the world, we might be better off, actually, have better housing standard compared with 50, 100 years ago, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera. But actually, we're becoming isolated, and actually that's making us sick, in a sense, giving us ill health, in the widest definition.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right.
And so one of the challenges, then, is it's not just about where education sits, it's about how we're a community together and where work sits within that. Now, one of the threads that runs through this that a lot of people will talk about coming from different angles is about measurement.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like, businesses will measure their performance on the profit. Governments will measure their performance on GDP. Universities have to measure their performance on the number of graduates you get, the number of whatever it is, number of people through the door. Do you think actually we need to have a look at a whole new set of measurements? If that's what we're obsessed with, and we seem to be obsessed with measuring everything, so that you might say actually a workplace that's happier and more creative, as you say, and has a sense of values in terms of where it fits in the community, is something that should have a measurement that's a higher value from a company that doesn't care a damn about anything.
Absolutely. And carry on.
No, I mean, if you think, how are we going to implement, how are we going to create that? So there's a connection between the education and work and so on, as you're describing, that changes our lives, that we can somehow measure. Is a key part of this, we have to create new measures. And in those new measures, that explains everything that we're trying to do.
I think we've already got the measures, because we can measure social benefit. You've talked about measuring individual sense of happiness, but we know how to measure social benefit and social innovation. And I believe if we simply entered some of these league tables of measurement for universities or schools, however you want to measure, you introduce the social impact of the institution. You would change the landscape of excellence, quite frankly. And it's back to the, why do we have universities?
Yep.
You know, rather than looking at the widgets that are produced, why are you producing the widgets?
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. So what you can, are you, Glasgow Caledonian University, involved in these social capital measurements?
We are, indeed.
And do you broadcast them? I mean, I know there's some companies in America and other places that are now kind of saying that this is actually the measure that you should have for a country rather than GDP, for example, which is a very, very crude measurement of something or other, which people get instead in. Are you doing these at the moment, and then are you communicating it? Are you talking to other partners about how you do these measures?
One of the core social capital measures is trust. It's also horizontal networks of engagement, communication, and exchange. Those are two key elements. Trust is an important one. So they're deeply embedded in the core values of the institution.
Mm-hmm.
And we have measured them in the past here. Are we systematically measuring social capital? Not now. Although when I was at the Health Education Authority for England, we introduced social capital as a measure into the General Household Survey.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you knew about that. That was a very long time ago.
A long time ago, but probably was kind of laughed at, was it?
It was it was poo-pooed a little, at the time. I think there's a place for measures like social capital, but I think we could construct a series of social benefit measures on the basis of health and well-being, and you can include some of this social the SDG actually goals within that framework. Yeah. That's the way I would go now if I was going to develop tools of measurement. Rather than maybe the social capital one, I would go for creating a tool that encapsulated aspects of the UN SDGs.
So that would be important, because if we all started to do that across the board, across the world, yep. in the different sectors,
yep.
and we were accepting that, that measure then starts to become a whole tool yep. in terms of how you are changing the world. Actually.
And we can get take up at scale pretty quickly if the UN take up that challenge. It doesn't need to be a complex measure because of their global compact of companies who signed up yeah. to their global compact. There are already tens of thousands of those.
Yeah. You know. But I think at the moment we're still learning on this. My view yeah. is that we haven't got there yet with this. Well, there's not confidence in it, but it's certainly growing. I would certainly agree with you. It has to be kept simple, because people need to grasp it and understand it. And sometimes, it's no disrespect to academics, but sometimes yeah. academics get involved and the whole thing becomes so complicated and everybody's lost why we started off yeah. thinking about it in the first place. So I agree. I think it has to be kept simple. It's very important. But then if you can have a similar measure from it, in the education world, to the mm-hmm. health world, to the business world, yep. etc., yep. then you're on to a winner, I would yep. have thought. You'd agree?
I absolutely agree. And if society continued to feel it was important for universities as organisations to contribute to social innovation, as well as scientific and technological innovation, then this kind of measurement would be quite challenging for some universities to actually deliver upon.
Yes, it would be, but it would be the right challenge they should be offered. It's yeah. about, I mean, as you know, my view is about we have to change the whole paradigm here.
Yeah.
Because actually all that's happening is we are mucking around at the edges, to be quite honest, and the system's not sustainable. So something's going to happen. So actually, for this to be systemic, we need everybody kind of coming on board here.
Yeah.
And if would you say this university knew a bit of an outlier there, a bit of a disruptor in the sector, or a leader, maybe?
Well, we quite like to think of ourselves as we disruptors, I must confess. But I think to be powerful, the we disruptors have to come together yeah. in a larger grouping, actually,
yeah.
and have a coherent, simple but coherent story to tell about this.
Yeah, and is there enough people with you, do you think, in the world? You know, you were mentioning there's some other universities as well, not just yourself. Is there yeah. enough? Is there enough of a kind of momentum building in the education sector around this that a voice starts to be heard?
I think there could be, but I think we would need to start a movement that embraced the Ashoka social innovation mm-hmm. Change maker movement, but went beyond that to look at collective and collaborative action. The Ashoka movement is a very powerful movement which encourages individuals to be entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. but somehow we need to find ways in making sure that the ways that organisations operate are also socially beneficial, socially innovative.
That's right.
Culturally sensitive.
You know, the Ashoka and others, like the Schwab as well, is yeah. another one. I mean, what they've done, I think probably correctly, is try to identify the leaders, social entrepreneurs, as yeah. leaders, and maybe as disruptors or outliers or whatever.
Yeah.
But actually and then that's fine, okay? But actually now, moving on now, it's mm-hmm. about how do you create the system. That's part of where we are coming from. It's how do you create
Absolutely.
The system change? So if you took, for example, trade, if you took fair trade as the example, we said, fine, there's fair trade. Well, why isn't every country doing fair trade mm-hmm. then? Why aren't governments making a law that the only way you can trade is by yeah. fair trade principles?
Yeah.
For example,
yeah.
is that's how you create the change? You don't need to be all the time kind of talking about these leaders in the fair trade, because
that's
actually
right.
it becomes part of what we do anyway.
That's
and
right.
that's the issue that's not happening. Mm-hmm. The social entrepreneurs are still quite isolated and doing their own
yeah.
thing, I think.
And in business, if we're going to have a movement that does change business models to become more sustainable. Mm-hmm. We do need all of those in the Global Compact to mm-hmm. make a stand and take a lead. And they will include some of your biggest businesses, yep. not just your Unilevers. But
Unilever's one, of course.
Of course it's one. But we need some other leaders in the field to come together and say, actually, this makes business sense. It makes sense for the planet. People are happier. Our profit isn't damaged, and our productivity goes up. Way, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
But we have to demonstrate it. We have to act. Another example is we're working with Nelson Mandela University mm-hmm. and a number of other universities in South Africa to actually reinvent a new university for Africa.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And actually situate it in the heart of the township.
Right. Okay.
So they have their own university,
yeah.
And these young kids from the age of 5 can go to university, but it's a real university, with mm-hmm. with a research strategy, but with a curriculum that's about problem solving, mm-hmm. how you tackle these global challenges, mm-hmm. and I want it to be led by Africa.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Are you talking about Joburg or Cape Town? Or?
We're talking about one of those two.
Yeah, that would
but
be really
my
amazing.
African partners. They will select.
Of course. I mean, I remember being in South Africa after apartheid times, and the ANC, obviously, one of their key parts, what their key stories was about education.
Yeah.
All the children went to school, albeit they had little material facilities, but they went to school. Yeah. And I remember seeing these kids in this township all wearing school uniforms walking together in a crocodile, and it seemed to be wow. It didn't seem to kind of fit the right picture, but actually it was because they put so much stead around education at the time, even though it was very challenging for them.
And these townships are huge, and they've got terrible health challenges. They're pinching electricity from the grid. It's amazing how they survive. But to be able to unlock all that in creativity and intelligence and make them proud and connected and have a sense of community purpose that goes beyond just basic survival would be fabulous.
Would absolutely be fabulous. But one of the things I always found that was kind of interesting in that is the kind of the contradiction of actually, they were, as a community, lots of these places actually. So you could actually build a lot on it.
Yes.
The issue was one of simply poverty.
Yeah.
But actually, the people together were quite united, and they have issues like any of us. Not living there, but actually, as a community, they were pretty together.
And that's one of the problems of social capital as a measure, because if you took our current social models, institutional models, they would be outliers because there's lots of violence against women in these townships. Yeah. There's, there is poverty, but there's lots of stealing and there's lots of illegal behaviour. So the social capital measure might say there's a lot of in-group social capital, but there isn't any bridging capital with the rest of the world.
Yeah. Some people might say there's also a lot of crime going on with people not paying taxes and in the rich world.
Indeed. Indeed.
Fraud at the highest level going on. Maybe their social capital, but these people will be very poor. I don't know. and I think maybe they're not very happy either. So, Okay, I think this has been a really fabulous conversation. We have to draw to a close. I could speak to you all day here about
likewise.
All this, because it's absolutely, to me, the education part of any new economy is absolutely fundamental, and you've got to get it right. But I think what you're describing, linking this to the values of the Millennium Goals, for example, and that all education establishments around the world are connected into those sets of values would be a fantastic start point in terms of building the economy.
And but we can do it, Mel.
Now that's great. The important point is we need people who can come together and say, we're going to do this, and get the vision and say, right, let's make that happen. And I know you're one of the people that will. So it's always fabulous talking to you, and this is such a great institution, and I would like to think that other universities could follow your lead.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, very grateful for your time today, and great speaking with you, Pamela.
Great speaking with you. Thank you.
Pamela's enthusiasm for driving social change through education is infectious, and we thoroughly enjoyed hearing her thoughts. We hope you did too. As always, we would love to hear from you on Twitter at Newism Talks or via our website newismtalks.com. Next week, we talk to another academic, Dr. Andrew Murray about creating health for all. See you there.